definitely, you know, need to happen. They need to keep continuing to happen. Dialogue is always better than no dialogue.
Expectations low for next U.S.-China trade talks. It's Wednesday, August 22nd. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Taiwan loses another diplomatic ally. Korean culture at summer camp. Rohingya forced to fish. Regaining feeling and recycling brewing waste. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Ahead of the latest round of U.S.-China trade talks scheduled today and Thursday, President Donald Trump told Reuters in an interview he does not expect much progress. He said he has no time frame for ending trade tensions with Beijing. U.S. tariffs on $16 billion in Chinese goods are set to go into effect just after midnight Thursday, with hearings underway for penalties on an additional $200 billion, with China vowing to match the new duties. Mr. Trump said it will take time to resolve the dispute because, in his words, China has done too well for too long and they've become spoiled. Christine McDaniel is a senior research fellow at George Mason University Mercatus Center, and she tells VOA's Victor Beatty she was not surprised at Trump's low expectation for this week's talks.
He often makes statements in terms of leveraging his negotiating position right before talks. I don't think we can read that much into that.
Would that be some sort of incentive for the Chinese to make progress?
Well, I think it just means that, you know, he's still looking for a big deal, and he doesn't necessarily expect that, you know, a major big deal is going to happen. Maybe it's a sign for the markets to say, you know, don't expect a huge, you know, end-all be-all deal this week. You know, it's just continuing talks.
You probably know that another $16 billion in Chinese goods will face new tariffs beginning this Thursday. Hearings began on a 25% duty on $200 billion more in Chinese goods, a wide range of products, and some American businesses are expressing real concern about the impact. Stephen Lang, representing the bridal and prom dress business, said that the industry, which is not yet targeted for tariffs, relies on China because labor costs were prohibitive in the U.S. He said their labor is like oil for the rest of the world. Tariffs would decimate the industry.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the heated trade rhetoric on China, you know, plays well with a lot of his base. But, you know, when these tariffs, which are really just taxes on American manufacturers and consumers, when those taxes are in place, then, you know, reality hits and it starts to really squeeze. I mean, we're really seeing every day another small or medium-sized manufacturer start to buckle. Because remember, over half of U.S. imports are intermediate goods. These are, you know, raw materials to other inputs that our firms need to produce their goods and services every day. So when these taxes start to really hit, our small and medium-sized firms are the ones feeling it first. And this is not about whether or not you support the president. This is about U.S. manufacturers, and they need access to globally competitive priced raw materials and inputs to stay competitive, to stay in business, and to keep employing workers.
Will these talks really move the ball forward in terms of resolving this matter? I understand these talks were called by the U.S., not by China.
They definitely, you know, need to happen. They need to keep continuing to happen. Dialogue is always better than no dialogue. What I'm watching most closely right now are the ongoing talks among the United States, Japan, and the EU. And this is where I think, you know, this is the most promising aspect of today's trade policy landscape, with the United States teaming up with like-minded allies who are just as frustrated with China's practices as we are, and trying to pen in stronger rules on these key issues like intellectual property rights, subsidies, state-owned enterprises, market access, investment restrictions, technology transfer. The list goes on. But it's unlikely that tariffs alone, especially just tariffs from the United States alone, will address these really tough issues. And so for that, you know, I'm really watching these talks with our allies that I think have more promise.
Christine McDaniel said China's trade policies are a major issue for it, and Beijing will continue to pursue its own interests. She said U.S. tariffs alone will not get to Beijing to change its behavior, and that's why she prefers a globalist approach, getting U.S. allies on the same page with Washington in their approach to Chinese trade practices. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll find right now on VOAnews.com. Aung San Suu Kyi defends policies toward Rohingya Muslims. Australian Prime Minister wins leadership challenge. Vietnam puts 12 people on trial for alleged subversion. Malaysia Prime Minister cancels Chinese-funded projects. Cambodian King pardons imprisoned land rights activists. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia, as well as our VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. China announced Tuesday that El Salvador has become the latest country to sever ties with Taiwan and establish diplomatic relations with mainland China. In signing the communique in Beijing with Salvadorian Foreign Minister Carlos Castaneda, State Councilor Wang Yi said history will prove establishing diplomatic relations with China is in full accordance with the fundamental and long-term interests of El Salvador, the 178th country to do so. It leaves Taiwan with just 17 countries with which it maintains diplomatic ties. Since taking office in 2016, five countries have broken with Ms. Tsai's administration from the mainland. Former Hong Kong City University professor Joseph Cheng tells VOA cross-strait relations have deteriorated since Ms. Tsai came to power.
Chinese authorities certainly want to exert pressure on her administration because of her refusal to accept the 1992 consensus, so-called, which subscribes to the principle of one China. So it is expected that such pressure will continue to be exerted on the Tsai Ing-wen administration as long as it refuses to accept the one China principle.
The announcement comes as Taiwan President Tsai Ing-wen completed a trip to Latin America via the United States. She challenged what she called China's verbal intimidation and saber-rattling and warned Beijing threatens peace across the Taiwan Strait.
Yes, the Chinese authorities certainly are very unhappy with President Tsai Ing-wen's stopovers in the United States and with two recent pieces of legislation on the part of the American Congress, namely the Taiwan Travel Act, allowing more high-level visits and exchanges between Taiwan and the United States, as well as the most recent National Defense Authorization Act, which promises stronger support for Taiwan's defense establishment.
Taiwan's Foreign Minister Joseph Wu said Taiwan would not engage in dollar diplomacy with China. El Salvador asked for funding for help for a huge port development project. Joseph Cheng said there had been a previous agreement in place where Taiwan and China agreed not to be played against each other by funding requests from smaller nations.
Actually, during the Ma Ying-jeou administration, both Beijing and Taipei came to an agreement that they would not be blackmailed by these small countries for switching diplomatic recognition. Naturally, Taiwan realizes that it is in no position to compete with the Chinese authorities in terms of trade and investment deals and economic assistance. Basically, diplomatic relations with these small countries are only of symbolic value to Taiwan, as long as Taiwan can maintain its economic and other ties with the major economies of the world. Its existence, its economy will not be threatened. Absence of diplomatic relations on the part of Taiwan with the remaining 17 countries also will not be of substantial importance to the island country.
The announcement comes ahead of a planned China-Africa summit in Beijing next month, where the Kingdom of Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, remains Taiwan's one remaining African ally. Happening now in Asia, U.S. authorities are asking for the public's help in finding a 28-year-old Chinese national who has been missing for 5 weeks, a victim of an abduction in Southern California, possibly by three men who knew him. Kidnappers initially demanded $2 million in ransom money. The ransom was not paid. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. You're with us today on VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us. For many children in the United States, summer is the time to go to camp. Kids have fun, but also learn new skills, like swimming, boating, theater, and horseback riding. One camp in St. Paul, Minnesota, mixes its fun with Korean culture. VOA's Carol Pearson narrates the story by June So after she visited the Korean culture camp.
Drum and dance is one of the classes that celebrate all things Korean during the week-long camp in Minnesota.
The camp was started in 1977 by parents, mostly Caucasian parents, who had adopted children from Korea. And they wanted their children to feel good about their Korean heritage and to experience Korean culture. So they began a summer camp.
안녕하세요.
Campers and volunteers start each day exchanging greetings in Korean in the auditorium of a local school. This year, the camp has 235 children from pre-kindergarten to seventh grade and 250 volunteers.
Most of the volunteers are the parents of the campers. It becomes a whole family experience. Those campers grow up. After they're no longer campers, then they become teen helpers. We have 100 teen helpers in our camp this year. And then after they're teen helpers, they can become young adult volunteers. And we actually have people who come back to our camp every year.
Parker Yellick is a teen helper.
I was adopted when I was 8 months old. But I was always self-conscious about, like, being a Korean adoptee. But when I, like, came here, I got to hear and see a bunch of other people who have the same story as I do. And it was really cool because it then helped me accept who I am. And it made me proud to be of Korean heritage. I kept volunteering because I wanted to help other kids who may have been like me. And it was also really fun.
College student and adult volunteer Kevin Cunningham has been to camp for 22 years.
Korean culture camp when I was a kid was my favorite week of the year. And I would say it still is as an adult because now I get to come back and see all the kids doing what I did, going to the class and learning about language, history, and doing taekwondo together. And of course, eating lunch together was always really fun.
Education director Hongju Lee recruits teachers and creates the curriculum.
I love to see the kids who are excited about what they are doing here, what are they learning. So that's why I've been here for 14 years. That makes me really happy.
Camp director Eksted adopted a daughter from Korea and says a large number of Korean adoptees led to high enrollment, as many as 700 in the 90s. Now the number is 250 to 300 every summer. There are fewer adoptees, but former campers now bring their own children. Other campers come from the Korean community. This new group has prompted changes.
So our self-esteem classes have changed. It is not so much about adoption anymore. It's about feeling good about being Korean, having a Korean heritage.
Eksted says as long as loyal alumni want to continue to make the Korean heritage part of their family, the future of the Korean culture camp looks bright. For producer Jun So, I'm Carol Pearson, St. Paul, Minnesota.
Coming up, new jobs bring less pay for Rohingya. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This news from VOA Asia. Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad says he's canceled three Chinese-backed multi-billion infrastructure projects. Mahathir made the announcement Tuesday in Beijing. He told a group of Malaysian reporters his country's ballooning $250 billion debt made it impossible to continue. Continue to see and share news and features at VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, tough working conditions make earning money difficult for Rohingya refugees, while Chinese trade negotiators head to Washington. These are the topics on today's VOA Asia Business Scene with Skylar Ogden.
In Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, where hundreds of thousands of people need food, shelter, and work, some businessmen are seeing opportunity. Access to cheap labor is a boon for some industries, like the fishing business. While refugees cannot work legally, many have found work catching fish, mending nets, repairing boats, or drying fish. Kamal Hussein is a Rohingya refugee and fisherman.
When I was back there in Myanmar, we had cows, we had land, we grew rice, we had better lives there. Now we are here in this foreign land, and we don't own anything here. Because we don't own anything, we work for others. That's how we are surviving.
The Bangladeshi district of Cox's Bazar now hosts around 1 million Rohingya from Myanmar, the vast majority of whom fled their country a year ago, driven out by the army. A fisherman here can earn about $1.20 to $3.60 for a five-day trip. Some Rohingya women dry fish for a daily take-home of $1.20 to $2.40. While the waters are often treacherous, especially during the monsoon, many Rohingya don't have a choice. Shafiullah is a refugee and fisherman.
People die in this profession. I've seen people die with my own eyes. But we need money, and that's why I continue to do this.
With refugees unlikely to be repatriated anytime soon, these men and women are likely to remain a captive labor force for some time. A Chinese delegation led by Vice Minister of Commerce Wang Shouwen will visit the United States in late August to talk about trade and economic issues. The U.S. invitation came just 1 week after Washington's decision to go ahead with 25% tariffs on $16 billion worth of Chinese goods. The latest round of tariffs has fueled outcries and aroused great concern among officials, analysts, and businessmen. Still, some remain optimistic about what the trade talks will bring. Chui Tiankai is the Chinese ambassador to the United States.
I'm quite certain that we'll be able to solve any problem issues between us because the long-term common interest is just there. It's so clear. There's no alternative to that. We are the two largest economies in the world, and we are both permanent members of the UN Security Council. And we have great responsibilities, not only to our own country, but also to the world.
Analysts say the United States will likely seek to lower tariffs and policies that press U.S. firms to transfer technology to Chinese partners and improve market access for foreign companies. The Chinese have said that the U.S. is demanding too much and ultimately seeks to dismantle China's government-supported economic system. Since the tit-for-tat trade war began, the dispute has hit China's stock market and currency, while sparing U.S. markets overall. The upcoming trade meeting will be the first major negotiation between the countries in more than 2 months. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news from VOA Asia. China says it will continue to provide aid to Tonga and other countries in the Pacific to help them achieve sustainable development amid a mounting debt problem in the region. Tonga's prime minister on Friday backed down on calls for Pacific Island nations to collectively lobby China to forgive their debts. You'll reap a wealth of information each time you visit VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, a prosthetic hand might look like a hand and move like a hand, but can it ever feel like a hand? Johns Hopkins University graduate student Luke Osborne says yes. As Faith Lapidus reports, Osborne has developed an electronic skin that can help amputees feel pressure and even pain once more.
Made from fabric and rubber embedded with conductive receptors, the stretchable skin wraps around a prosthetic hand, sending electrical impulses from pressure to existing nerves at the stump of an amputated limb and onto the brain.
We've fashioned it in a way so it can go over the fingertips, and so it fits really nicely. And we've modeled it after the way our skin is. So we have different receptors in our skin, and we looked at that to say, okay, well, if we were to make an artificial skin, this epidermis, how could we make it to more or less do what biology is doing?
The degree of pressure impulses depends on the item picked up. So a blunt object can be held and moved around, while a pointed object pokes the electronic skin, bringing a feeling of pain and a reflex reaction. Professor Nitish Thakur, who leads the neuroengineering and biomedical instrumentation lab where the epidermis was developed, notes that pain is essential for survival.
Why do we really have a sense of touch and skin? If you really think about it, it's to protect us, right? And how do we protect ourselves? If it's hot, there's a sense of pain.
While electronic skin could have applications for robotics, for now, Osborne hopes it can help restore lifelike sensations that amputees thought they'd lost.
Being able to feel like something is touching the hand that you haven't had for many, many years is pretty fascinating. And so that's generally something that is really exciting when an amputee feels that again.
Although the current research involves pain and touch receptors, researchers say the same principles may one day be used to trigger other sensory feelings, such as pleasure. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Americans drink a lot of beer. That's according to the Beer Institute. Almost 100 liters for every drinking-age American each year. And that's a lot of malted barley, the main ingredient that gives beer its alcoholic kick. Even smaller craft breweries in the United States are throwing out some 2 million tons of the spent grain each year into landfills. But one entrepreneur has found other uses for all of that wasted grain. She's recycling spent barley into flour that she later sells to bakeries and restaurants. VOA's Jill Craig taps the keg to give us the flavor of the story.
Beer may not seem like a big culprit in the battle to fight food waste, but the beer brewing process uses up thousands of kilos of barley. After the malted grain has been soaked in hot water to release its sugars, the resulting golden brew is fermented into alcohol, and the spent grain is thrown away.
And just in New York City, there are 6,000 tons that goes to the landfill every year. So if we can at least start making New York zero waste, that will be great.
Bertha Jimenez and her team recycle used barley grain and turn it into flour by drying, then grinding, sifting, and packaging the flour by hand. The result is a so-called super flour that's either light or dark. Lights come from the IPAs, ales, and pilsners. The darks come from the stouts and the porter ales.
Oh, we call it super flour because of the nutrition. So it has, if you compare to an all-purpose flour, it will have 2 times the protein, 12 times the fiber, and only 1/3 of the carbs of an all-purpose flour.
Baker Peter Indris buys super flour to make shortbread cookies. He says he wants to help reduce America's food waste problem while still making a tasty product.
Because it has like a nice crumbly texture, and it's a lot more full flavored than other flours. You really taste like a maltiness from the beer making process.
But those full flavors come at a premium. Rise's super flour currently costs about 5 times that of regular all-purpose flour. But Jimenez says she hopes future automation will eventually lower the price. That should leave some of us more money to spend on beer. Jill Craig, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Find us online, streaming on VOA Asia Facebook and our website, voanews.com. And we'd love to hear from you. Write to us. voaasia@voanews.com is our email address, or you can reach us on any of our social media platforms. We'd like to thank everyone who's listening on the radio, Falcon Radio at Adamson University in the Philippines. We also thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Kelvin Fowler, managing editor Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Have a terrific day.